the robbers went home and discussed their bad luck, not realizing, of course, that their every conversation was being recorded and that we were going to be there waiting for them. They decided that one of the three had to be a snitch. And there were only two of them talking at this time. But when the third one walked in the door, they threw him to the floor and searched him for a wire or a recorder or something. Of course, he didn't have one. So they continued to discuss why they were having such bad luck. They were having to pay bondsmen and lawyers all of the money that they had. And so they looked across the street from their apartment and saw a place that developed photographs, and decided they'd go over there and burglarize that place, see if they couldn't get some money. So they did. We sat in our apartment and watched them go in the building through the front door with a key. We had no idea they had a key to that building or how they got the key. In fact, never did find out how they got the key. But at any rate, they went in the building and proceeded to go through everything. I was had been promoted to lieutenant by this time. This was in 1967, and I was still in internal affairs, but helping the intelligence division, and I could not let the rest of the police department know what I was doing, and because we had too many leaks in the department of information. But I had to, in some way, get the police department out there to go into that building. So I got out to my car, my police car, which was an unmarked car, radioed for a sergeant to meet me and told him that I had been flagged down by a civilian, told that he saw people going in that building. And so he called for some backup, and they went in the building and found the three men, and they were caught again. To make a long story short, where they're concerned, they were finally sentenced to 18 years in prison and went to prison. Broke. During this same period of time, Martin Luther King was killed, and the riots began to start throughout the nation. I was sitting at home one evening in 1967 when I received a call that rioting had broken out in downtown Nashville. By this time, I was also head of the SWAT team and reported to the police station, and the rest of the SWAT team formed, and we began to circulate in the black community along with the National Guard SWAT team. The rioting in Nashville went on for approximately 10 days, almost 2 weeks. We were on the streets pretty much all of that time, except trying to grab a few hours sleep. Every day, maybe we'd get 2 or 3 hours. And the Salvation Army fed us during that period of time. They were the only things available as far as food was concerned. They had a truck that would make the rounds with bologna and cheese sandwiches and hot coffee, and that kept us going for that period of time, and we'll forever be grateful to the Salvation Army. Fortunately, there were not there was not, as a matter of fact, any people killed in the city of Nashville during the riots. There were some people wounded. A lot of the rioting took place in the neighborhood of Tennessee State University. And as a matter of fact, on one particular evening, the Tennessee National Guard SWAT team and the Metropolitan SWAT team, led by myself, engaged in a one-hour exchange of gunfire with students from that university, from a dormitory. And it ended when we all got into, that is, the SWAT teams, got into a military troop carrier and threatened to go through the all-glass lobby if they didn't stop the gunfire. with this threat and with the troop carrier only inches from the plate glass doors and windows of the lobby, the gunfire ceased, and we searched the building and confiscated many weapons. I'd just gotten a new police car that day, and it was full of bullet holes by the end of the first two or three hours of that particular shootout. I'm happy to say that no police officer other than myself was injured badly. I received a brick to the kidneys and had to go to the hospital, but no one else seemed to receive any injuries during those particular riots. The riots also occurred again in 1968. By this time, my career was continuing to move forward, and I was asked to take over the homicide division of the Metropolitan Police Department. I had been an investigator most of my career and had been successful, and the chief of police asked me if I would take that job, and I did so. The first weekend that I was head of homicide, 7 murders took place in 50 hours. We solved 5 of the 7 murders. I went home after going to work on a Friday morning. I went home the following Tuesday morning. I had not been to bed or had any sleep during that period of time. This is not particularly unusual for the head of a division such as homicide when something like this happens. 7 murders in 50 hours is a lot of murders. Of course, Nashville has always been a dangerous city. In fact, at one particular time, it was called Little Chicago because of all the crime involved. There's a lot of money in Nashville, and any city that has a lot of money is going to have a lot of crime. Also, the police department, as I stated earlier, was not all that great a police department. We did, however, gain some publicity as a better police department. 1 year after the article came out in Life, we were written up as one of the most improved departments, so I'm happy to report that. Getting back to my short stint in homicide, I stayed there 6 months, and I became exhausted, physically exhausted. I ended up in the hospital, and during my stay in the hospital, the mayor of the city of Nashville at that time was Beverly Browley, and I had known the mayor during my career as a police officer. In fact, I had driven the mayor. I had stood in for him on occasions and made speeches for him when he couldn't appear, and I had known him, he and his wife, quite well. He called to see how I was, and I asked that he allow me to go back to internal affairs, that I'd had enough of the homicide division. He laughed and said, of course, you can go back to internal affairs. I think the reason that I got exhausted, though, is I had no faith or confidence in my investigators because there were so many crimes that went unsolved. I tried to solve them all, and therefore I never went home, and you can't do that. You have to have good investigators. You have to have men who know how to work and will work on their own without that type of close supervision, and I couldn't seem to learn that, and I ended up in the hospital. So I went back to internal affairs, and after 7 years in internal affairs, I was promoted to captain, and I was then assigned to the training division as the director of training. When I took over as director of training, was in approximately 1969 or 70. Now keep in mind that, as I stated earlier, here's a captain on the police force who only had a ninth grade formal education, who was now director of training of the Metropolitan Police Department. And when I went there, the training division was in a small five-room house on 52 acres that belonged to the hospital board of Nashville. And it was an old tuberculosis hospital located there. And our classroom was in the chapel of that hospital. And one classroom also in the hospital itself. I asked the chief of police at that time and the mayor if they would support me in attempting to build a new training academy for the city of Nashville, for the Nashville Police Department, the Metropolitan Police Department. And I was assured from both of them that they would back me in every way, so I put in a grant for approximately $1 million with the federal government, and we received that grant and built a very professional police academy. We also had a gun range where we held National Rifle Association shoots as far as police firing is concerned, and we were very proud of the police academy. That was completed in 1972.